I said my silent apologies to Si Fu Chen and went inside. Maya was making the last of the Pete's coffee. Her hair was blown into a mass on one side of her head, as if she'd been walking on the beach. She was wearing my last clean t-shirt. She looked up, smiled, and for a second burned the images of dead bodies out of my mind, but only for a second. "You look like hell, Navarre, and you just about wore this poor girl out last night." "I'm always great in the sack after getting the shit kicked out of me. I'll remember that." She pulled me closer by the elastic of my shorts, then kissed my face. I winced. "Speaking of last night," I said. She smiled, a little sad. "Leave it alone for a while, Tex, okay?" I sat down with coffee at the counter, pushed Robert Johnson's butt out of my face, and stared at the 45 Maya had taken from Red, the stacks of 50s I'd taken from Beau Carnow, the crumpled photo of Randall Halcombe we'd found on Terry Garza's corpse. I didn't like the connections I was coming up with. 10 years ago, my father somehow finds out about the scheme to fix the contract on Travis Center before he can make it public. The people behind the plan use Randall Halcombe to silence the sheriff. Then, before the FBI can track down Halcombe, his employers silence him, too. Maya and I looked at each other. "First rule of assassination," I told Maya, "kill the killer." Maya frowned. "And Beau Carnow just happens to be there with a camera in a field in the country in the middle of the night. That's a hell of a coincidence." I agreed. It didn't make sense. Neither did the fact that blackmail payments for a 10-year-old murder had only been happening for the last year. I rubbed my eyes. "We need to know about Guy White, whether the mob's really in this or whether it's just convenient for somebody to make it look that way. We need to know what the police have on Garza's murder and Moraga." "And Lillian?" said Maya quietly. I stared out at the crepe myrtles. Maya came closer. She put her hands lightly on my shoulders. "First, you need to eat something," she said. "Then we'll see about the police." I rubbed my eyes again, pondering how to make breakfast from one beer and some baking soda. Thinking about my empty refrigerator led me to thinking about Larry Drapuski's card sitting in my medicine cabinet. I looked at the time. 9 o'clock. Almost a civilized hour. If I made it sound urgent enough, he could be here in under 30 minutes. But only if I was prepared to discuss police matters in the serious businesslike manner to which he was accustomed. Which meant only one thing. I peeled a few 50s off Beau Carnow's stack. "First," I told Maya, "we go grocery shopping." Chapter 39. I wasn't sure whether Pappy Delgado was glad to see me or just happy to meet Maya. I harbored illusions that the old grocer took an interest in my well-being. It was probably closer to the truth that he took an interest in Maya's white culottes and brown legs. Whatever, it was a slow morning in his little pink Christmas-lighted store, and Pappy decided to give us a guided tour of the produce aisle. On the way, he helped me correct my Californian Espanol, so I sounded more like a Tejano than a Cuban. Sandia instead of patilla for watermelon agua fresca. Forget Guinea for banana. He seemed endlessly amused to be schooling the gringo. Finally, while Maya was picking out avocados, Pappy nodded his huge nose her way and grinned at me.
"Y la chica?" he whispered.
I told him he was a dirty old man. He just grinned and told me he bathed daily, preferably not alone. I called Drapuski from the payphone at the corner of New Braunfels and Eleanor and told him we had things to talk about and pan dulce to eat. He grudgingly agreed to come over.
"You want to give me some context here, Navarre? What's the problem?"
"Heard about the murder at Chef Construction? You guys had some deputies on the scene, I remember." He was silent.
"Okay, how about Terry Garza, dead on Austin Highway? We called it in anonymously last night."
He was still silent.
"Can I take that as a yes?" I asked.
Holy hell, Drapuski said. Then he hung up on me. Back at Queen Anne, I heated up the pan dulce Pappy's wife had made in the back of the shop that morning and added a little butter and cinnamon. By the time they were out of the oven, Drapuski was at the door. He wasn't in a jovial mood. Before he said anything, he took a fistful of pan dulce and sat on the futon. On impact, it sank a few feet into the foundation. Robert Johnson was flushed out from underneath and belly crawled all the way to the closet.
All right, said Drapuski. Now what the fuck is this about homicides?
Then Maya came out of the bathroom. Larry turned redder than he already was and pulled off his hat. He started to get up.
Sorry, he said. Didn't know you had company.
Maya smiled and motioned him to stay seated.
That's all right, Lieutenant. I'm enchanted. I didn't know anyone apologized for saying fuck anymore.
Ah, Larry said.
Maya laughed, then introduced herself. One handshake, and Larry was in love. He grinned cinnamon and butter. He tried to make room on the futon for her, and just about goosed himself with his nightstick. Since he'd totally forgotten he was supposed to be pissed at me, I decided to help him out.
Homicide, Larry, you were saying?
He tried to scowl at me. Maybe it was for Maya's benefit.
I checked the telex on Garza a few minutes ago. Nothing's even been posted yet.
Maya sat back as much as she could on the 2 inches of the futon not occupied by Drapuski's body.
Is that unusual?
What's unusual is that I hear about it from your friend here first. His eyes bored into me with all the accusatory power of a faithful hound dog I'd just kicked. I also followed up on Carnile this morning. I had one of my deputies swing by his apartment, then his studio. They were both empty. Like Carnile's left town.
Maya and I looked at each other. Larry waited.
So, you want to tell me?
He asked. I told him. By the time I got to last night's soiree in Terry Garza's trailer, Drapuski didn't look too happy. When I'd finished, he put his hands together like he was praying and pointed them at me.
You walked out on a murder scene after removing evidence.
That's one interpretation, I admitted.
And the only solid evidence you have about this construction scam you obtained during a B&E at chef's offices, which pretty much ruins it for the courts.
I nodded. Larry's huge red eyebrows came together. He exhaled.
Son, you probably just ruined the best chance we'd ever have to string Guy White up by his balls for murdering your dad. I would have given anything, any time in the last 10 years for that chance, and you just...
He stopped, collected himself. I could tell he was counting silently.
All right. Let's say you broach this whole thing as a hypothetical. Okay, fine. I'm not obliged to follow up. But here's my hypothetical advice. Get your ass down to SAPD and cooperate like hell.
That's it?
He exploded. God damn it! You better believe the FBI will be in this sooner or later. When that happens, they'll take one look at the way you've screwed up the scene and your ass will be flying at half-mast on the Fed's flagpole. Then I won't be able to do anything for you.
As we stared at each other, the ice cream truck trolled by outside. Since last week, its version of La Bamba had worn down a few octaves to a funeral march. And what about Rivas's investigation on Lillian? What about the homicides? Drapuski slowly brushed the pink sugar off his hands.
Let's just say it would be damned unusual for me to ask SAPD straight out without a reason.
We sat there at an impasse until Maya decided to help. She rested her hand on Larry's knee and smiled sadly, earnestly.
Could you find a reason, Lieutenant?
Larry shifted uncomfortably, mumbling something to himself. He looked down at Maya's hand. His expression broke.
Oh, shit, he said. Friday, I'm doing some off-duty security work with a buddy of mine from CID. Maybe we could talk.
Maya's smile to Drapuski was probably worth it. I was too busy watching the linoleum in the kitchen. "And if Friday's too late?" I asked. Larry stood up. His hand on my shoulder felt like warm lead.
"Get your ass downtown, Trace, before Friday, and stay the hell away from Guy White."
We were silent.
"Damn it, son," he said. "There's nothing else I can do."
"You got any connections with the Blanco Sheriff's Department?" I asked.
"Randall Halcombe was killed out there. I'd like to know more about the scene."
Larry frowned.
"We could go out there alone," I said, glancing at Maya. "All right," Larry grumbled. "I'm off at noon. I'll pick you up then. Long as you do me two favors."
I gave him my winningest smile.
"Anything for you."
"Stay put," he said. "And
stop reminding me of your goddamn father."
Chapter 40. I was hoping Drapuski would settle for one out of three. We didn't stay put, and we didn't stay the hell away from Guy White. My first mistake was trying to get through Brackenridge Park on a Sunday morning. The minute we turned onto Mulberry, we were stuck in a line of station wagons and low-rider Chevys, heavily pinstriped pickup trucks with sunbathers sprawled out in the cabs. Since we weren't moving anywhere, drivers in opposite lanes carried on conversations in Spanish, exchanged beers and cigarettes, flirted shamelessly with the passengers who were invariably girls with red hair and tight black tube tops, even tighter cutoffs. The smell of barbacoa and hamburger smoke drifted through the trees as thick as fog. Picnic spots had been staked out as early as the night before along the river banks, so as near as I could tell, the people in the cars just cruised in very slow circles, eating their Sunday lunch while they drove. Maya got several propositions and enough whistles to fill an aviary. Nobody whistled at me. Since there was nothing else to do, I pointed out the miniature railroad tracks, the rent-a-pony stables, the place where the great Brackenridge train robbery had taken place. Maya looked at me for a translation.
"The what?"
"My dad's claim to law enforcement fame," I told her. "A group of basic trainees from Lackland. Got loose on day 25, drank some beer, decided to steal a few ponies, and play Jesse James. They put bandanas on their faces, laid this dead tree across the tracks, then hid in the woods and waited for the kiddie train to come by. Robbed it at gunpoint and made a getaway."
"Charming," said Maya.
I held up my hand. "There's more. My dad was a deputy at the time. Now that I think about it, that afternoon's the only occasion I remember him being off duty and sober at the same time. I think he was taking me to the zoo. When he spotted the robbery, he told me to stay put. A local station got some great footage of him, all 300 pounds, waving his shotgun like he was Judge Roy Bean and lumbering after this group of drunk pinheads on ponies. Afterward, he got drunk and gave the media a dynamite interview about bringing law to the Wild West. The next year, they elected him sheriff."
"The media?"
"Basically," I said.
Maya nodded. I think she was staring at me to find my father's genetic code, trying to decide whether chasing pony-mounted bandits with a shotgun was a dominant or recessive trait. Whatever she concluded, she kept it to herself. We finally made it into Olmos Park and turned onto Crescent. When we pulled in front of the White House, we found that Mr. White had been renovating. He'd had a presidential fountain installed in his front yard, and three workers in sweaty denim were busy digging trenches and laying down copper pipes, trying to finish the plumbing. White had also installed a 300-pound Hispanic linebacker at the front door. The new doorman looked at us with a confused expression as we walked across the lawn.
"Howdy," I told him.
His head sloped straight down into his shoulders like a lampshade. His features were so flat they almost looked smeared. The only things that added any contour to his face were his hair and his sunglasses. Both were huge, shiny, and black. He looked like he had once tried to listen to a calculus lecture and had never quite gotten over it. His eyebrows were drawn together, his mouth frowning, open.
"B.B.," he said.
Maybe it was his name, maybe that's as far as he'd ever gotten with the alphabet, whichever, he didn't seem to have much to add. He crossed his arms and waited for us to go away, or try climbing over him. I looked at Maya. She shrugged.
¿Hablas mejor español?
I asked. Bibi watched me as if I were the most amazing insect in the world. If I were any more entertaining, I was afraid he'd start drooling. Behind us, the fountain workers were taking a break. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw them toweling the sweat off their faces, watching us. One of them quietly bet $5.
Okay, I said.
We'd like to see Mr. White, if you tell him we're here. Bibi seemed to be watching my mouth, trying to learn the words.
Or you could just stamp your foot, I suggested. Once for yes?
Maybe if we just asked inside, Maya said, smiling innocently.
When she tried to walk through the door, Bibi's arm blocked her at the waist. Then a shape moved behind the beveled glass door. My old friend Emery opened it and stood in the entrance. He didn't look particularly thrilled to see me. Today he was wearing a pinstripe suit that was about three sizes too big. His shirt collar was so huge it wrinkled up like an asshole around his neck when he tightened his orange tie. I offered him my hand.
¿Qué pasa, buddy?
Emery made a sound that was somewhere between a laugh and an asthma attack.
You are one stupid son of a bitch.
He put several extra syllables in the word stupid just for emphasis. We'd like a few minutes of Mr. White's time, I said. You remember the drill from last time. Emery shifted his weight from one foot to the other.
That's a good one.
He looked at Bibi for support.
Ain't that good?
Bibi was no help. Even though Maya had backed off, Bibi's arm was still blocking the doorway. He'd probably forgotten why it was there.
Mr. White isn't disposed to take visitors on Sunday morning, Emery said. Mr. White made it pretty clear that includes you, Mr. Navarre. I'm real sorry.
Bibi stepped forward so I could admire his chest, while Emery tightened his orange tie a little more.
He might be interested in what we've got to say this time.
Emery gave me a lopsided grin.
I surely doubt that, Mr. Navarre.
I looked at Maya. She smiled sweetly.
Gentlemen, she said, you are absolutely sure you couldn't just ask Mr. White, really. I think it would be best.
She thinks it would be best, Emery repeated to Bibi.
Bibi nodded, as if he might get it after a few more repetitions. Emery grinned so much his cheeks turned into canyons.
I think he's just gone back to Japan, honey, and Mr. Sheriff's boy here can go on back to Frisco. That'd be a whole lot easier.
People always show you their impressive high kicks when they boast about martial arts. They neglect to tell you that the higher you lift your leg, the more you are telling the world, here are my balls, please hit them hard. Sure, a high kick has more reach, but in truth, the quickest, safest, most devastating kick, and the one that is hardest to defend against, is a good low kick to the shin. It worked wonders on Bibi. He crumpled backward into the foyer without ever losing his confused expression. Of course, it didn't help his comprehension when he cracked his head against the marble floor. Emery was less fortunate. Maya grabbed him by his orange tie and slammed his head into the beveled glass door, then dropped him on top of Bibi.
Japan! She spat.
I was gratified to discover that Emery was keeping the .38 air weight in his belt these days. Maya took it. I think she would have kicked Emery in the ribs just for good measure if we hadn't had more company to deal with.
We'd barely stepped into the foyer when two more linebackers came down the grand staircase that circled the back wall of the living room. Their uniform of choice seemed to be Italian suits. Their weapon of choice seemed to be 9mm Glocks. At first, they were too busy running down the staircase to fire effectively. And when they got to the bottom, they had to circle to either side of a column-shaped glass and rosewood display case full of crystal statuettes. "Good morning," I said. "Mr. White at home?" I stepped forward, nice and easy, I thought. Maya, the calm and reasonable one, chose instead to start firing Emery's .38 at the display case. It's amazing what a beautiful grenade you can make out of some hollow-tip bullets and a bunch of Waterford crystal. Shards of glass reindeer, penguins, and delicate swans turned everything in a 15-foot radius into a winter wonderland, including the two men's faces. They were still yelling on the steps as Maya walked up to the staircase and picked up the two Glocks they'd dropped. After I'd checked for holes in my body and made sure that I hadn't soiled my trousers, I asked her, "What did you figure the odds were they'd ventilate my chest before you managed to pull that off?" She kissed my unbruised cheek. "I didn't figure. Just making sure." We tried the oak double doors on the left. Before I really knew what I was doing, my arms came out, grabbing, and my waist instinctively twisted and sank into luau position. Pull down. The guy with the blackjack went over my knee, face first, into the door jam. "This way," I suggested to Maya. At the French doors that led to the backyard, Guy White stood waiting for us. His parabellum pointed lazily in our direction. He'd apparently just walked in from the patio and was leaning against the doorframe in his khakis, an untucked blue button-down, and slippers. His mole-colored hair was carefully combed and gelled, and his expression was completely peaceful.
"You are the most persistent man," he told me.
Fortunately, there was no Waterford crystal to shoot at in the room. Maya dropped her three guns on the nearby desk. Guy White smiled at her.
"Thank you, my dear."
Then he lowered his Glock and waved his other diamond-bedecked hand toward his 7-acre backyard.
"I have some exceptional croissants from Port-la-France," he said. "I was just reading Roddy Stinson out on the gazebo. Won't you join me?"
Chapter 41
"Beau Carnow," said White. "Quite a colorful character."
He laughed without making a sound. Then he sat back in his white wicker chair and proceeded to dissect his croissant. He peeled off each layer and ripped it into small squares with perfectly manicured fingers. If the croissant had been alive, I think White would have had the same unconcerned smile on his face.
"You know him, then," I said. I drank my mimosa out of my crystal glass. It was mixed with Veuve Clicquot instead of Dom Perignon, but the orange juice had probably been fresh squeezed by illegal aliens who had just been flown in from the valley that morning, so I decided not to send it back.
White said, "Only peripherally. Because of my patronage to local art galleries, why do you ask?"
"Curiosity. And the fact that Carnow's just about the only one besides you and me with an interest in the disc who isn't dead at the moment."
No reaction. White looked out over his gardens and waved his champagne glass toward the north.
"What do you think, Miss Lee?" he said. "I'm thinking about tomatoes over in that corner next to the mountain laurels."
If Maya was trying to look hard and unapproachable, she was failing miserably. She smiled without even looking at the future tomato patch and agreed that it would be a lovely spot for gardening. I swear to God, White's eyes twinkled at her on command. When he was ready to entertain my questions again, he pushed the croissant carcass and the express news away. He leaned forward across the table, looking earnest and helpful.
"I assure you, Mr. Navarre, Beau Carnow is no associate of mine. I've only met him on a few occasions, and I found him tiresome."
He let his eyes reveal just a hint of annoyance, a benign peevishness toward that quite colorful character, Mr. Carnow.
And Dan Chef?
Maya ventured. Guy paused momentarily, then decided to smile. I thought for a minute he would pat Maya's head.
What of him, my dear?
Read your paper, I suggested. I think the Moraga murder story dropped below the fold today, but you're still getting page one press. I couldn't get White's attention away from his imaginary tomato patches. His tone stayed pleasantly distracted.
As I said to you before, my boy, faulty assumptions.
So you have no relations with Chef Construction, I said. No knowledge of how their business changed in the mid-80s? I finished my mimosa.
I'd have thought about that time you would have been looking for less high-profile opportunities yourself. The drug trafficking trial, the investigation of my father's murder. It must have been very tiresome.
I warranted only a strained sigh from our host. But you take what you can get.
All I can tell you about Chef Construction, my boy, is that Mr. Chef, that would be Mr. Chef Jr., has little to do with the, shall we say, the day-to-day running of business. Perhaps,
he raised a finger, as if he'd finally spotted the ideal place for some pink azaleas.
Perhaps, you should speak to Terry Garza, the business manager. That might be more enlightening.
We'd made arrangements, I said. They were canceled last night, when we found him with an anti-cucho skewer sticking out of his neck.
That did it.
White lifted his eyes off his future garden and stared at me. I think he was genuinely surprised. Then it passed.
How unfortunate.
Once the police come to question you, yes. I put the photo we'd found in Garza's trailer on top of Guy White's newspaper, facing toward him.
What I think, I told him, is that you are either in this photo or you know who is.
Chef Construction started some extremely lucrative and extremely questionable dealings with city construction contracts 10 years ago, Mr. White, and it's an arrangement which is still going on. I'd be surprised if anything that large could have escaped your notice. Either you were involved directly, or you'd make it your business to know who was. White looked over at Maya, smiled like one parent to another when their child has said something cute and foolish.
Mr. Navarre, I do not appreciate being scapegoated. As I told you, I went through much grief 10 years ago when your father died. Much unwarranted suffering.
You're telling me you're being scapegoated again? He stretched like a cat.
Convenient solutions, Mr. Navarre.
Help me find Carnow, then. He's got the answers. White gave me a look I couldn't quite read. Behind the bland smile, he seemed to be deciding something. He got out of his chair and surveyed his lawn one more time. Then he took an index card and a pen from his pocket. He wrote something on the card, folded it, and let it fall to the table.
Goodbye, Mr. Navarre.
He stretched again, raising himself up on his toes.
So nice to meet you, Miss Lee.
When Guy White was a half acre away, strolling past his newly planted verbena, Maya picked up the index card and read it.
Try Mr. Carnow at the Placio del Rio tonight.
That's the Riverwalk Hilton downtown.
Maya put her champagne glass on the table. She looked at the index card again.
Why do I feel like we've just been offered a sacrifice?
Or someone's unwanted ballast.
I looked across the yard at Guy White, who was now stepping carefully but easily between rows of his blue princess. Like this was his minefield, and he'd crossed it many times before. Chapter 42. After that, the clean air of the country felt good. By 1 o'clock, we were speeding along the banks of the Blanco River in Larry Drapuski's Jeep, and Larry was rapidly consuming the Shiner Box and beef fajitas we'd brought him as a peace offering.
Three beers? Maya said. What happened to setting a good example for your youngers, Lieutenant?
Larry laughed.
You get as big as me, Miss Lee, then you can see what three beers does to your blood alcohol content.
Drapuski's red Jeep seemed right at home in the hill country. So did Larry. Off-duty, he was wearing bootcut Levi's and black leather Justins that must have been made from an entire alligator. A red shirt that made his hair and his freckles seem a little less neon by comparison. Howdy-doody on steroids.
So, what is it you folks are expecting to find? Drapuski said. It's been a lot of years since they pulled Halcombe out of that deer blind, son. You expect something with an orange flag on it just sitting out there all this time?
That'd be fine, I said. Larry laughed. The fajita disappeared in his mouth, followed closely by most of the beer. Maya looked on in awe. Drapuski's friend with the Blanco County Sheriff's Department had the unfortunate name of Deputy Chief Grubb. We met Grubb outside the Dairy Queen, a place he had obviously frequented over the years. His white hair had a slightly greasy tinge to it, and his upper body, once that of a football player, had swollen up over his belt buckle until it bore an uncanny resemblance to a dilly bar. Larry made the introductions.
Halcombe, Grubb said by way of introduction. That was a luncher.
Meaning? When Grubb grinned, you could get a good feel for how much he liked his coffee. The layers of yellow on his crooked incisors were like glacial flood lines.
Meaning we ate it, son, he told me. Never found a damn thing.
It was a 10-minute drive from the DQ in Grubb's unit. Along the way, he told us about a slave ranch they'd closed down a week before. 17 Mexican migrant workers kept in a barn, chained up at night, worked with a whip and a double-barrel shotgun during the day. Then he talked about the domestic disputes he'd broken up so far this week, the new Mexican restaurant in town, the high school team's chances next fall. By the time we'd driven to the site and walked through 5 acres of brush and live oaks, Maya and I knew every bit of gossip Blanca had to offer, including where to buy your duty-free liquor, what fields the marijuana planes landed in, and which local wives were likely candidates for a steamy affair. All I needed now was a place with cheap rent.
There it is, Grubb said finally, wiping the sweat off the back of his neck. Ain't much.
The blind had probably been old and abandoned when Randall Halcombe's corpse was stuffed into it years ago. Now it was just a collection of rotten planks and sheets of plywood on 4 wobbly posts. It had tried to fall down a long time ago, but had been stopped by a nearby mesquite that was still propping it up like a sober friend trying to support a drunk. There was a frayed rope ladder hanging from the back. Even if it had held together long enough to climb, the blind would have collapsed under the weight of a full-grown man. Grubb and Drapuski started trading stories of gory hunting accidents while Maya and I poked around. Nothing was marked with an orange flag. 5 cows were standing in a clump in the shadow of the blind, hiding from the afternoon sun. They looked at me with a kind of lazy resentment, wondering what I was doing there. I started to ask myself the same question. I'd been hoping, maybe, to match the terrain to Carnell's photos, get a sense for where the shots had been taken from, why Halcombe's employers had chosen this site for a meeting, and why Carnell might have been here. So far, nada. Grubb, I called. The deputy chief came over next to me, with Drapuski and Maya following. I nodded at the deer blind. Did you determine whether this was a dump site or not? Grubb took off his deputy's hat and wiped his forehead on his arm.
A lot of blood about 100 yards down that way. That's where they killed him. Then they dragged him over here.
They, as in two? Grubb nodded.
Could be more. There were tire tracks down that way. FBI took some plaster mold footprints, too. I don't recall exactly what the story was.
Cause of death?
Old boy got it right between the eyes at short range. Hell of a shooter. You know what a Sheridan knockabout is?
22-caliber single-shot pistol, Maya said almost absently. Went out of production in 62, only 20,000 were made.
Grubb and Drapuski gaped at her.
In khakis and a white tank top, her eyes invisible behind large black sunglasses, Maya looked like a safari veteran. There was a single line of sweat running from her ear to her jaw. Otherwise, the heat seemed to be having no effect on her. She'd been looking toward the deer blind until she noticed that she'd become the center of attention. She shrugged.
"Just a guess,"
Larry grinned. "A Sheridan," I said. "My dad had one, actually. Got it right after Korea." Grubb was back to swabbing his forehead.
"Sure. They were popular with a lot of the vets. Target shooters, mostly. Thing was, it's a mighty strange gun to murder somebody with. Very clear striations on the bullet, easy to pin down. And by 85, they weren't what you call standard street issue."
I thought about a picture I'd seen in the chef's house. Dan Sr. as a young soldier off for Korea. I thought about the box of .22 ammo in Dan Jr.'s office closet. "And you said it's a single shot." Larry whistled silently.
"You got to be pretty sure you're shooting to kill a man like Halcom with a gun like that. Pretty damn ballsy."
"Or," said Maya, "you've got to be not really planning on murder. You might bring a gun like that along for protection to a dangerous meeting if it's the only gun you have. Or for a little leverage if things got rough, but probably not for a premeditated kill. Either way, you're not talking about a pro."
She looked at me.
"Not the mob. They'd come a lot better prepared."
Grubb looked Maya up and down one more time, a mixture of confusion and budding respect on his sticky forehead.
"What'd you say you were again, honey? Chinese?"
To her credit, Maya left his face intact. She said dryly,
"That's right, Mr. Grubb. The ones who built the railroads, you remember."
I looked back at the cows and tried to think. The cows didn't offer any suggestions. "Is there anything else?" I asked Grubb. The old deputy took his eyes off Maya, looked at me, and shook his head.
"Just a dead end, son."
Drapuski shrugged. He looked sorry, but not surprised. I could have left then. I had something to go on. Our two law enforcement escorts were definitely ready to get back to the air conditioning in the dilly bars of a friendly Dairy Queen. But after sweating in the sunshine and swatting the mosquitoes for a few more minutes, I started walking down toward the place where Halcom had been shot. There were more mesquite trees down in the hollow. The dry brush was so high we had sticker burrs as thick as fur on our pants by the time we got to the murder site. It was a small clearing, barely accessible by two tire ruts that led off into the woods. It was the place in Bo Carnow's photos.
"Not a bad place for a meeting," Larry said. "Very low profile."
He started picking the sticker burrs out of his crotch. Maya leaned against a dead tree. Grubb just looked at me, losing patience.
"What are you thinking, son?"
he asked. I wanted to give him an answer. I didn't have one. "Who owns this land?" I asked. Grubb thought about it.
"Right now, I don't know. It was pretty much abandoned in 84. Old Mr. Baker passed on, and none of the sons had moved back into the house. Then in 86 the ranch burned down. It's changed hands plenty of times since. Nobody uses it nowadays, except the neighbor's cattle."
"What neighbors?"
"Vivian's on the north, Gardner's on the south."
Neither name rang a bell. "A ranch house burned down?" Grubb nodded. He told me about the big electrical storm they'd had in 86. Lightning had caused a dozen small fires, one of them taking the old ranch house up the hill. He looked at me suspiciously.
"I reckon you'll want to see that, too."
Drapuski laughed. "Why not?" I said. It took a lot of compliments and the promise of a free dinner to get Grubb up that hill, but we finally made it. There wasn't much left of the house, just a thin place in the grass where the foundation had been. I couldn't figure out why it looked familiar. I made a complete circuit around the place.
"Is this going to get us something besides a suntan, son?" said Drapuski after a few minutes.
That's when I tripped over something large and metal. Grubb and Drapuski came up to see while I dug it half out of the dirt. A piece of black iron piping that had been shaped into cursive writing, about 3 feet long and a foot high. It said, Lazy B.
Yeah, said Grubb. I remember that. The old gates to the place. What do you know?
It took me a minute to place the name. Then something else clicked.
Lazy bastard, I said.
Grubb glared at me.
What was that, boy?
Miss Lee and I saw a photo of this place recently, taken at night during a meteor storm. Grubb nodded, more hot now than interested, daydreaming of ice cream and shade. Drapuski and Maya looked at me, both of them trying to read my expression. My throat suddenly felt very dry.
So this is the angle Karnow shot from, Maya said. That only makes sense.
No, I said. Lillian said something before she disappeared. She and Karnow used to go on photography shoots, sometimes for days at a time. She mentioned camping out on a godforsaken hilltop in Blanco. She mentioned photographing a meteor shower.
Funny coincidence, Drapuski said, looking back into the hollow where Halcombe had been shot.
I tried to imagine Randall Halcombe in the deer blind, curled up, with a perfect red hole between his eyes. But I kept coming up with Lillian's face.
Yeah, I said. Funny.
Chapter 43.
When we got back to Queen Anne Street, Maya looked tired and angry. She lay on the futon, staring into space, while I wrestled off my sticker burr-covered jeans. Finally, they flew across the room and buried Robert Johnson in his bed of dirty laundry. I don't think he even noticed. I lay down next to Maya, hugging her from behind, my face in her hair. When I reached for her hand, it was a clenched fist. After a few minutes, she sighed.
Trace, get out of here with me. Destroy that damn disc if you need to, but get out of here.
I tried to pretend she hadn't said anything. I wanted to just lie there, keep my eyes closed, listen to Maya breathing as long as I could. But she pulled away. She sat up and looked down at me, the anger in her eyes watered down to frustration.
Two men have died because of that disc, and now you've started advertising you've got it. To me, that makes the rest insignificant, even Lillian, especially Lillian.
I shook my head. I can't just leave it, and I can't destroy it. Not if it's about my father's killers.
You want to get yourself killed instead?
There was no correct answer to that. After another minute, Maya lost the spirit even to glare at me. She sank back into the cushions.
God damn you, she said.
I lay there for a long time, contemplating how else I could possibly screw things up. Mentally, I started placing bets on who would be coming through my front door next with a gun. But of course, my life wasn't complicated enough. The ironing board rang. When I picked up the receiver, I knew I was either listening to a rock tumbler or an aging smoker trying to breathe. Carl Kelly, retired deputy, my father's old buddy.
Hey, son, he said. Didn't hear from you yet. Thought I'd call.
Yet. Then I realized it was Sunday afternoon again. I'd been in town exactly 1 week. In Kelly's mind, I'd started a tradition when I'd called him. Hi, Carl. I settled in for the duration and opened a Shiner Bock. Maya watched me curiously while Carl launched into a discussion of the newest terminal illnesses he'd read about. He talked about how worthless his son in Austin was. Then he started mentioning past discussions we'd never had. He repeated himself. Finally, I listened more carefully to the background noises on the other end of the line. Carl, I interrupted, where are you? He was silent for a minute, except for his breathing.
Don't worry about it, he said.
His voice was shaky. His tone asked me to please worry about it. What hospital, Carl?
Ah, I didn't want to trouble you, he said. My neighbor brings me in for a cold, and they say I've got pneumonia, some fucking liver disease. I don't know what all. Can you believe that?
He started to cough so loudly I had to pull the receiver away from my ear. When the coughing subsided, it took a few moments for his gravelly breathing to start up again. What hospital, Carl? I said again.
The Knicks. But don't worry about it. They've got a TV set up for me. I've got a little money left. I'm okay.
I'll come by, I told him.
That's okay, son.
He held the line for a minute longer, but he didn't need to say anything. I heard the loneliness and the fear even louder than the hospital TV. What? Said Maya when I hung up. Somebody from my past, I said.
Of course.
My look made her sorry she'd said it. The irritation drained out of her face. She dropped her eyes. I dug another handful of 50s out of Bo Carnow's retirement fund and made sure Maya still had bullets in her 45. I'll be back later, I told her. Maybe Maya asked me a question. I didn't wait to hear it. Chapter 44. The Knicks looked like exactly the kind of building Superman would have loved to jump over in the 1940s. After saying a few Hail Marys and grinding up 12 floors in an antique elevator, I found Carl's semi-private room at the end of a narrow blue-lit hallway. I thought I'd been prepared to see Carl as an old man. I was wrong. I couldn't find his face anywhere in the thinly coated skull that looked up at me. Oxygen tubes ran from his nostrils like an absurdly long mustache. If he'd been any more frail, they would have had to weight him down to keep him from floating out of bed. The only thing still heavy was his voice.
Hey, son, he croaked.
At first, I didn't see how those watery white eyes could focus on me enough to recognize who I was. Maybe he thought I really was his son. Then his eyes slid back over to the TV screen and he started talking about the old days with my father. After a while, I interrupted. Jesus, Carl, how could you have not known you were sick? He looked away from the TV and tried to frown. He put his hand out for mine.
Hell, son, he said.
But he didn't have an answer for me. I wondered how long it had been since Carl looked in a mirror or had somebody pay him a visit so they could tell him he was wasting down to a skeleton. I made a mental note to find his son in Austin and have that discussion, if I live long enough.
Tell me, how's it going?
Carl said.
About your daddy.
You should rest, Carl. They got you on vitamins or anything? He opened his mouth, rolled his tongue into a tunnel, and coughed so hard he sat up. In the state he was in, I was afraid he'd broken his ribs, but he just sank back into the pillows and tried to smile.
I want to hear something.
So I told him. There wasn't much point in hiding anything. I asked him if he remembered my dad saying anything about Travis Center, or Chef, or even vague comments about a big investigation he wanted to do. I told him I couldn't figure out how my father would have stumbled onto the scheme to fix the bidding. I'm not sure Carl even heard half of what I said. His eyes were fixed lazily on the television. When I was finished, he offered no comments. He was staring at some cowboy cheerleaders in a beer commercial.
Your daddy and the ladies, he said. I guess you never heard the stories.
Too many stories, Carl. His hand looked so fragile I was surprised how hard he gripped my fingers.
Don't you doubt he loved your mama, son. It's just...
Yeah, he loved the ladies too much.
Nah,
said Carl.
Just Ellen.
I don't know why the name still made me uncomfortable.
I'd heard it so many times from people outside the family. At home, it had never been an issue, no big deal, really. Just every Thanksgiving, my father used to get a little teary-eyed after his third bourbon and coke. Then he'd raise his glass, and Garrett and Shelley would raise theirs, too. Nobody said anything. Nobody invited my mother or me to ask. But we knew who they were drinking to. That momentary ceasefire between the three of them was all that was left of Ellen Navarre, my father's first wife. But the name still made me feel like an unwelcome guest in my own family. The studio audience cheered the winner of Jeopardy.
"Nothing ever took root for your daddy after Ellen died," Carl said. "Not really."
I wished he would go back to talking about Alzheimer's or maybe prostate cancer. Anything but my father's love life.
"Right before he got shot," Carl said, "he finally thought something was working out, you know? Of course, he always thought something was working out with some lady."
I nodded politely, then realized what he was saying. I don't remember anybody like that. Carl just looked at me and breathed gravel. I got the point. She was married.
"Eh," he said. "They usually were."
For a minute his eyes drifted off, as if he'd forgotten what we were talking about. Then he continued.
"Your dad was a hard-nosed son of a bitch, son. But good Lord, he could turn soft over a woman. You should have seen the roses he bought once for a Laredo whore."
"Carl," I said. He stopped. I guess he saw well enough to read my expression in the blue light of the television.
"Yeah. You're right, son, enough said."
I sat with him for a while and watched the game shows. The nurse brought in some applesauce, and I helped him eat it, spooning the excess up his chin and into his mouth like he would a baby. After an hour, he said,
"I guess you need to go."
"I'll try and come back tomorrow."
"You don't need to do that," he said,
but his hand wouldn't let go of mine. He looked at me for a minute, then said,
"You look just like your mama. Just like Ellen."
I didn't tell him he was wrong. I just nodded, swallowing hard.
"You find this girl of yours,"
Carl said, squeezing the words into my hand,
"and you hang on to her, Jackson."
Maybe he was talking to me, maybe to my father. At that point, it didn't matter. When I left him, he was still recounting the old days, telling Vanna White what a son of a bitch my father had been.
"Roses for a Laredo whore," he told her. "Some kind of roots."
Carl Kelly held on feebly to his oxygen tubes, like they were the only things still anchoring him down. Chapter 45. Maya acknowledged my existence long enough to throw a notepad at me. Then she went back to pretending to read the newspaper. "He called about an hour ago," she said, "right after Detective Schaefer." The note said, "Carlin, 5 hours and counting. Talk to me." I tore off the note and threw it in the trash can. I missed.
"And Schaefer is interested in talking about Terry Garza," Maya said. "I stalled him as much as I could."
"Any more good news?" Maya dropped the paper longer this time, enough for me to see that her eyes were red. She sat on the futon with her legs tucked under her, wearing a black pantsuit with sequins. Her ponytail was tied back in a new way, with a small cluster of red and blue ribbons. It all looked slightly familiar, but not on her. I frowned. "What else happened?" I asked. "Did you go somewhere?" She tried to look hurt. Then the tension became unsustainable. She cracked a smile.
Your mother came by,
she admitted. My expression must have been good. She started laughing.
You asshole,
Maya said. I'm still mad at you. Her eyes said otherwise. And what did my mother say?
She was mad at you too, Maya said. The smile was evil. We commiserated. We talked.
I sat down on the futon next to her, still frowning. I tried to look threatening.
Talked?
She did a bad job of covering up her smile.
We buried the hatchet, more or less. She took me out as a peace offering. This was right after you left.
I looked at the pantsuit again, the ribbons in Maya's hair. No, she nodded her head enthusiastically.
We went shopping at Solo Serve.
It's over, I said. Homicides, disappearances, and now you're going to Solo Serve with my mother. Maya shrugged. Then she kissed my cheek.
I was going to tell you that I decided to leave tomorrow, she admitted. I even made reservations. Now that I've seen the clearance rack, I may never go away.
I needed a beer very badly. Of course, Maya and my mother had drunk them all. And here, I thought you'd been crying, I yelled into the refrigerator. Your eyes are just red from looking at price tags.
Serves you right, she said. And this is for you.
She produced a yellow plastic Solo Serve bag from under the futon, then pulled out an extra-large t-shirt that said, Welcome to San Antonio. On the front, in neon colors, was a depiction of San Antonio's one claim to heavy metal history. Ozzy Osbourne, urinating on the cenotaph in front of the Alamo.
It spoke to us, she said. It just screamed Trace.
It's lovely. How do you say she-devil in Mandarin? I guess I look suitably angry. Maya walked up, pressed against me, and kissed my chin.
Okay, you're forgiven now.
I'm forgiven, she smiled.
Show me the Riverwalk, Tex.
Neither Carlin McGaffrey nor Detective Schaefer were thrilled to hear from me, especially since I answered most of their questions with, I don't know, or promises to call them back in the morning. My right ear hurt from the insults by the time I hung up, but I was otherwise intact. After the week I'd had, it was difficult to find clothes without blood or Mexican food on them, but I still declined to wear my new t-shirt to the Riverwalk. Maya just smiled, enjoying her revenge as I searched the dregs in my closet. Robert Johnson played kamikaze, dive-bombing my clothes from the kitchen counter every time I made a pile. Otherwise, he was no help as a fashion consultant. By sunset, we were driving south on Broadway into downtown, Maya looking like several thousand dollars and me like spare change. The streetlights were just coming on and the sunset was longhorn orange when we walked down the stairs of the Commerce Avenue Bridge into the crowds on the Riverwalk. Take away the glitz and tourist dollars, and the Paseo del Rio is basically a deep trench that winds through the center of downtown San Antonio. Just south of East Houston, the river gets diverted from its course and makes a huge lowercase B, looping all the way east to the convention center, then back past La Vallita to Maine, where it reconnects with itself. Put back the glitz and the tourist dollars, and even a native has to admit it's pretty impressive. Tonight the air was warm and the mariachi music was everywhere. Colored